Hi, this is Cynthia Davis. If you haven't figured it out yet, we're in a really bad culture war. So on our show today, we're going to talk about Notre Dame, how cities are destroyed, sex education, and more. This show is for the purpose of sharing with you what you can do about it.
I'm an American. Red, white, and blue.
Welcome to Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host, and I'm here to help. From parenting to public policies to political advice, join me in taking America back one family at a time. As a speaker, writer, former legislator, mother of seven, and wife of one for over 30 years, I bring you my experience.
Don't lose your freedom.
And now it's time for Homefront.
Don't lose your freedom. Let's talk about it.
Welcome to Homefront. This is Cynthia Davis, and on our show today, we have E. Michael Jones. He is the editor of Culture Wars magazine and the author of numerous books and a frequent lecturer. So welcome, Dr. Jones.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I'm glad to have you. I've had people who listen to my show ask frequently if we can get you on. So you have a great reputation. And just the phrase culture wars brings out an emotional response in all of us. It's been at least 20 years since the 9/11 attack on America, and that one single event seemed to be able to pull us all together. Possibly for the last time. Now we're at a place where if we were attacked again, I don't know that we could pull together. I don't think we can even talk about who did it anymore. And we're very fragmented. So tell me what you think about the condition of our country, the condition of our culture wars, and what got you involved?
Okay, well, the term came into being around 1992. Pat Buchanan used it at the Republican convention. It was a response, I think, to what happened around that time was the takeover of the universities. This was the beginning of the term political correctness. A group of revolutionaries centered around the ideas of Michel Foucault and postmodernism took over the universities. And because the universities are influential, because they train people how to talk, they train people what they're allowed to say, what they're not allowed to say, and they've been doing that ever since 1992, so that's going on 29 years, something like that. The influence has spread throughout the culture. So what you have over this period of time is basically the United States becoming one big university campus with all of the university speech codes and irrationality that goes along with it. This was all a form of control. And over this period of time, it's gotten more and more draconian. Now, what happened over this period of time, I'm going to try and bring this right up to date. Without going into too many details, and you can ask me questions about the details. But what happened over this time is that the country got more and more polarized. As the country got more and more polarized, the repression became greater. And so what you had over a period of time is that certain people felt more and more alienated. They felt more and more demonized, more and more alienated. And at a certain point, a lot of these people felt they couldn't talk anymore. And as soon as you feel you can't talk anymore and you're really upset, you start to act. And since it's the United States of America, you usually act with a gun. You take a gun in your hand. And the most recent incident of this type of thing is the shooting in Poway, California. Man walked into the synagogue, shot two people, killed one person. This was in many ways a sequel to the shooting in Pittsburgh about a year ago, I believe. 13 people died in that shooting. What you're seeing here is a dialectic, what Hegel would call the dialectic, where one action leads to another action, and then you have another action in response, and it constantly goes back and forth between these two groups. So right now, we know a little bit about this one because the man who did the shooting in California was a fairly intelligent guy. He's a 19-year-old nursing student, fairly bright, and he wrote down what his thoughts were. He had been influenced by white racism. He was also a Christian. He tried to put those two things together. It didn't work. And the result was the sense of frustration led him to go out and shoot people. Now, this leads to a counter reaction. So the reaction yesterday, which is only 2 days after the shooting, is the ambassador, the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, now says the time for dialogue is over. We need to turn anti-Semitism into a crime. Now, if you read the man's manifesto, this is exactly what the man intended. He wants to bring about revolution through increased repression. The repression will shut other people up. These people, once they get shut up, they will be prone to violence, and then they will attack another synagogue, and then there will be more repression until finally Ernest's plan, the man who shot the people in California, is revolution. He hopes that revolution will break out. I don't know what's going to break out, but I know that right now people like you and me who have the ability to talk to each other need to take back this ground from these two extremes, because these two extremes are going to drive us right over the cliff.
Well, I agree with you with what you're saying about the universities. And instead of us taking back our universities, we've funded them to a greater level than ever before, which only drives up the cost of tuition. The people in the universities are coming up with worse teaching than ever before, like an education on how to be socialist. And we're not getting much affirmation for traditional values. Our universities, even the ones that claim to have a Christian basis, like Notre Dame, which I definitely want to hear you give us your thoughts, we are seeing a horrific cultural slide because the kids' minds are being tainted. And you can't deny that it will have an effect on the next generation. Now, what happened in 1992, though, that it enabled you to pinpoint a date on when the colleges really fell off the cliff?
Well, going to graduate school at Temple University, I majored in literature. And one of my teachers was Stanley Fish, who was one of the ringleaders of the takeover of the university during this period of time. He, along with the deconstructors, were involved in basically redefining literary criticism, which is important because literary criticism is basically the form of discourse that we have. It's kind of replaced philosophy, which has gone into irrelevance. It has become philosophy. It talks about discourse and what you can say and what you can't say. And these people, there was a book came out, Roger Kimball, I believe, wrote, called Tenured Radicals. And this was at the time when people like Stanley Fish reached the kind of pinnacle of their power because they had taken over the MLA, the Modern Language Association, which was the basically the broker for jobs in the English profession. So that's why I'm talking about 92 as the time when everybody became aware of that. It's also the time Pat Buchanan used the term culture wars. And it was also the time that I was now doing research into what happened to the Catholic Church during this period of time. The idea that came to my mind was that I used to think it was an internal struggle within the Catholic Church that led to the chaos. But I realized that there were forces outside of the Catholic Church trying to influence it. And the first thing that came to my mind was Kulturkampf in Germany under Bismarck. And that's why I use the word culture wars. It's my translation of Kulturkampf. Now, to get to Notre Dame, there's a movie out now called Hesburgh. It just premiered in South Bend on Friday. And it's basically an attempt to hagiography, which is our word for just lives of saints. Hesburgh is being portrayed as a modern day saint. And the proof of this is his involvement with the civil rights movement. And so we have the famous iconic photo of Hesburgh and Martin Luther King with their hands like this singing "We Shall Overcome" in Chicago. Now, everybody knows this. It's kind of part of the contemporary civic religion to believe in the civil rights movement. But what most people don't know is that this was taken in Chicago. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with Chicago, but it's not located in any of the southern states of the United States of America. It was part of the Yankee North that won the Civil War. And so, therefore, there was no segregation whatsoever in Chicago. So what was Martin Luther King doing in Chicago? Well, he was breaking up Catholic ethnic neighborhoods. And here you have Father Hesburgh now siding with the man who was breaking up Catholic ethnic neighborhoods. This is a story I described in The Slaughter of Cities, but I'm bringing this up as some indication of how the story of what Notre Dame, the role that Notre Dame played in this period of culture wars that we're describing.
Well, a few years ago, Notre Dame had a lot of respect as a Catholic university, the most prestigious one in the United States of America. And now we have a place where they invited Barack Obama to speak and gave him an honorary degree. And I can't imagine how you could say that that's okay. If the people running the university truly were Catholic, they would be so appalled at the idea of somebody promoting evil. The evil of abortion alone should have been enough. And I don't recklessly call people evil, but when you believe it's okay to kill innocent babies, unborn, that's evil enough. But he voted in the Illinois legislature for them to be allowed to die after they're born. So how could a university that claims to be Catholic allow such a thing to even happen?
Well, that's a good question. I wrote a book called Is Notre Dame Still Catholic? And in that book, it's about 25 years of me writing articles about the situation at Notre Dame. And the last one is the story of Barack Obama showing up at and getting the commencement, giving the commencement address. Now, they didn't have to give him an honorary degree. They could have just asked him to do the commencement address, but they went out of their way to kind of curry favor with him at the very time that he was persecuting the Catholic Church, not just abortion. We all know he was pro-abortion, but he was the one who was forcing the Little Sisters of the Poor to fund contraceptives for their violate their conscience, fund contraceptives, doing things like that. It was unconscionable what this man was doing. But the point here is that this is indicative of the whole trajectory of Notre Dame, which began when Father Hesburgh became president in 1952. During this period of time, Father Hesburgh consistently sided with the oligarchs against the Catholic people of the United States of America. I can give you instance after instance. It's written up in my book. But I've already mentioned the social engineering that took place in the big cities like Chicago. I cover that in my book, The Slaughter of Cities. He sided with the people who were destroying Catholic ethnic neighborhoods. After he did that, he sided with the Rockefeller Foundation, funded a series of secret conferences at Notre Dame, whose purpose was to undermine the church's teaching on contraception. It's like, throughout this entire period, whenever it came to basically a choice between representing the interest of the oligarchs or representing the interest of the Catholic people or the Catholic faith, Notre Dame has always sided with the oligarchs. There's no exception that I can think of.
Well, I'd like to get your opinion of this Pope. I remember when he was first elected, I was sitting in a tire shop getting four new tires put on my car, and the mechanic came into the waiting room and called my name. And just as a point of humor, I yelled back out to him, "I can't come right now. They're about to announce if the Pope is in favor of contraception or not." I just thought that was, I just wanted to wake up the waiting room. But it's so sad that only a few months after that, he made that very painful remark about how people shouldn't breed like rabbits, which is inflammatory and disparaging of any family that adheres to the Catholic teaching. And now you've got all his socialistic ideas that he's promoting because he doesn't understand how capitalism works, apparently. And now he's trying to tell the United States how we're supposed to handle our immigration problem. So give me your perspective. Am I wrong?
Well, I was favorably disposed toward the Pope at the beginning because I went to Rome. I complained about the fact that the church was not preaching the gospel in certain areas. And I said, one of the areas was usury. And so they said, well, why don't you do something about it? So I said, okay. I had just written a book, a big, thick book called Barren Metal, which is a history of economics as the conflict between labor and usury. I said, okay. So I wrote something up on usury, how it was wrecking economies, how it had a bad effect on the environment. And they put it in the encyclical. It's in Laudate Si. Okay, so I was happy about that. At this point, I felt that there was a crucial moment it was a crucial moment and something had to happen. The church had become too close to the American empire over the period of the papacy of John Paul II and Benedict XVI. John Paul II was involved in the anti-communist crusade that eventually brought down the Soviet Union. Benedict followed along in this tradition, and there were lots of negative, there's negative fallout that was part of this thing, and I thought that the situation needed to be clarified. I thought that a man from South America might be able to do this, but since then, we now realize that there was a group of people who had been waiting out in the cold for about 28 years. The entire time of the papacies of John Paul II and Ratzinger had been biding their time, and now they felt it was their time to come back. I'm talking about a group called the St. Gallen Group. Cardinal Cosper is a representative of this, and there were other people. One of them was Cardinal McCarrick. Now, what we now know is that Cardinal McCarrick was a homosexual. And not only after that story came out, Archbishop Vigano wrote a letter claiming that there was a thing called the homosexual mafia in the Catholic Church that had basically prevented any type of effective action on any number of issues. And I think personally that it was this homosexual mafia that led to the resignation of Pope Benedict XVI. So one of the main groups, one of the main strongholds of the homosexual mafia in the United States is the Jesuits. Father James Martin gives constant scandal. It's constant scandal. People are outraged that a man, a Jesuit, calls himself a Jesuit, can promote the homosexual agenda the way he does and not be disciplined. You probably figured out that the Pope is also a Jesuit. What we're seeing now is Jesuit solidarity. And I don't see, as a result, any attempt on his part to deal with this issue. The recent synod in Rome on the abuse crisis was chaired by Blaise Kupich of Chicago, Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago. They resolutely ignored the homosexual problem. And because they ignored that problem, they are not going to solve the problem, the crisis facing the church right now.
Right. You can't solve it if you can't address it. So right. What's the craziest thing you've seen happen in your lifetime in America, turning our culture wars against the good guys? Tell me one story that defined your understanding of where we are today.
I grew up as a guinea pig in an experiment. I'm 70 years old. I was born after World War II, and at that point, the government, after defeating fascism in Europe, turned and just started to wage war on the Catholic Church in the United States of America. I was driven out of my Irish neighborhood, ethnic neighborhood, by racial migration, which was being orchestrated by the Ford Foundation and the government. I watched colleagues, friends, classmates get destroyed by the sexual revolution, which was also being orchestrated. I've watched the church lose one battle after another. The church has lost every single battle in the culture wars since 1965. That's over 50 years now. It still hasn't regained its footing because there are lots of reasons, sin being one of them. The clergy was sexualized during this period of time. We are still reaping the bitter fruit of that. But the main problem here is that the church doesn't understand that they were in a war, that there were people who were out to destroy them. They came away from Vatican II thinking that the world was, everybody loved them and that they had no enemies. That's not true. It will never be true. And until they wake up and understand who the enemies are, they're never going to be able to deal with it effectively.
I actually grew up in Chicago. My dad grew up in Detroit and Dearborn. If you could look at what has happened to Detroit and especially Dearborn, it is not even a ghost of what it used to be. And it really should cause us all to grieve. What do you know about the slaughter of cities? And how did we take two very fine cities, I will call them Chicago and Detroit, and turn them into places that are not desirable? They're not safe. And even my city where I am now, St. Louis, has one of the highest murder rates in the whole country. And I don't understand how, if we're making all this progress, what happened to our great and glorious cities? And it's all of them. It's not just those. I pick those out as examples because I know firsthand.
Right.
But you look at San Francisco even, and now you read stories about how people are, I hate to even say it, but leaving their excrement on the sidewalks. Right. I mean, what country is this? That's third world. That's not America.
Right. Well, first of all, San Francisco is different. That's a different story. I don't want to talk about San Francisco. But what do Boston, Philadelphia, Detroit, Chicago, and St. Louis have in common? They were all cities in the North that had large Catholic populations. The government initiated war against the Catholic population of the United States of America in the 1950s and 60s by destroying their neighborhoods. They destroyed their neighborhoods. In doing this, you destroyed the backbone of these cities. These were productive people. These were people who worked hard. They had coherent, vibrant neighborhoods that worked. People helped each other out because they were alike. They came from the same type of group. The United States started promoting what they called integration and then diversity and then all the other isms that came about on this time, basically as a form of social control. Well, you know, we used to say the operation succeeded but the patient died. That's exactly what happened to these cities. They basically killed these cities. I have intimate, my oldest son lives in Dearborn. I was in Detroit, and this is when he first moved there. I decided, why isn't anyone talking about this place? It became famous after a while because it was the setting for RoboCop, and then there was a genre developed called ruin porn, which was basically pictures of old ruined buildings in what were the best and most prosperous cities of the United States. So you took the picture, everybody knew about it, everybody saw it every day, but nobody felt that they needed to explain what happened. And that's why I wrote The Slaughter of Cities. I mean, even my granddaughter, my oldest granddaughter, we're at Eastern Market in Detroit, and she says to me, "Granddad, who broke this place?" So she's 6 years old, and she can figure out somebody broke this place, but nobody's talking about it. That's what it was. It was war. It was war against the Catholic population of the United States of America.
How does a city break a population? How do they break their own city? Obviously, shouldn't we have the same goal of everybody prospering?
The first thing you have to understand about America is there's no such thing as an American. There never was. Okay, the fundamental understanding of America is the triple melting pot, which is basically that after three generations, you become one of three ethnic groups, Protestant, Catholic, Jew. And these groups, America was like Yugoslavia in that it had three ethnic groups based on three religions. And it was like Yugoslavia in the fact that these ethnic groups were at war with each other. That is the history of America. So these people don't think, well, we're all Americans. No, they think the Catholics are taking over Philadelphia and we better do something about it. That was the WASP feeling in Philadelphia. I know a lawyer at one of the white shoe law firms in Philadelphia, the head of the firm didn't know this guy was a Catholic. And he said to him, basically, we had to keep the city from falling into the hands of the Catholics. And that's why we promoted Wilson Good, first black mayor of Philadelphia, who ended up dropping a bomb on Southwest Philadelphia and destroying 8 square blocks of real estate.
Are you serious? Are you talking about a bomb?
A bomb from a helicopter, a bomb. It was called MOVE. It was a black revolutionary group called MOVE. They had taken over, fortified a house, and Wilson Good dropped a bomb on it, and the bomb exploded. Maybe they had gasoline in the house or something like that, but it burned down 8 square blocks of Philadelphia property. That's Philadelphia. That's in the 1980s. You can look it up. Look it up on the internet by MOVE. Okay? That's warfare. This is warfare. There was no such thing as an America. There were groups who were willing to destroy other groups in order to maintain their power in America. And if they had to destroy the city in order to save it, you know, the way we used to talk about Vietnam, they were willing to do it. And they did it. They did it. If you look at Philadelphia, look at Detroit, you can see they succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. They did it. They destroyed the city.
So now we're shipping in Muslims from foreign countries, especially Africa and Somalia. We've got people coming here from Syria and all these refugees. I don't agree with bringing them out of their country if they're that far from home. I think it makes way more sense to keep them closer to home so that when their country stabilizes, they can go back to home. And there's clearly no intent to assimilate. Ilhan Omar, the new Muslim congresswoman, said we're not going to assimilate. So how do we make a moment of unity if we have people who are refusing to become Americans even though they just came here?
If you're talking about America and unity in America, I don't see any hope for it anymore. It's not going to happen. That being said, the election of Donald Trump was a step in that direction. I think he had one of the great mandates, political mandates of our time. The people of Indiana, for example, woke up and realized that nobody represented their interests. They were the victims of the looting of the industrial manufacturing infrastructure here. They voted for Donald Trump because he articulated a platform known as America First. This was the work of Steve Bannon. It was a brilliant move at the end of the election. America First referred to that political movement in the 1930s, which was based in the Midwest. And it did not want to get America involved in war in Europe, and it wanted to build up the manufacturing base, Okay, now the war was in Syria, and the manufacturing base was being looted, but Donald Trump promised to do something about it. What we had, unfortunately, is Israel first as the policy as soon as Trump took office. That has been our foreign policy ever since. It has proved to be a disaster for this country. We now have the foreign policy of this country being controlled by psychopaths like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo. John Bolton is a protege of Sheldon Adelson. The reason we do not have a nuclear agreement with Iran is there are three reasons. Sheldon Adelson, Paul Singer, and Bernard Marcus, three rich Jews, now determine the foreign policy of the United States in their interest and the interest of Israel, and not in the interest of the American people. That is a huge betrayal of the people who voted for Trump and voted for America First. And I think he will live to regret that decision.
Well, we'll find out what we're going to regret. But there's obviously, you don't seem to have a lot of optimism. I'm with you, though, on your understanding of how we're going to perceive what's happened in the past. My question is, how do we move forward? If you were elected president of the United States, what would you do? What kind of policies do we need to adopt if we want to unify ourselves again and push for an economic policy that's going to bring us back to our own prosperity?
First of all, in terms of foreign policy, cut off all aid to Israel. Zero out aid to Israel. They have enough money. They can get along without us. And if they can't get along without us, then that's their problem, not our problem.
What about cutting off all aid to every foreign country? I mean, I don't even get that. We're supposed to be using our tax dollars for our best interest. Why do we give any money to any other country?
Right. Because we want to control them. That's the short answer to your question. And the mechanism that controls them is known as the American Empire. The American Empire is on its last legs. Okay. The only question is it going to end peaceably, let's say like the end of the Soviet Empire, or is it going to end in nuclear cataclysm? With John Bolton in charge, I would place my money on nuclear cataclysm at this point, because he's a completely irresponsible psychopath and he should be removed from office immediately. What we need to do is make an orderly retreat away from the American Empire, back to the American Republic, back to the only principles, the only consistent conservatism this country ever had, which is America First. Back to America First. That also means strengthening the manufacturing base. That means raising wages. That means no outsourcing. That means an honest economy rather than a gambling casino economy, which is what we have on Wall Street. That means bringing Wall Street corporations in line with the common good in America. I mean, these are all steps. That means dealing with the debt problem, straightening out the universities, eliminating student debt. It means getting back to the real priorities, the economic priorities of the United States of America, and abandoning completely the whole structure, the whole mechanism, the whole infrastructure of sexual revolution, which has been nothing but a form of political control.
Do you think we can go back to before the sexual revolution?
Individually, yes. I did a show last night of a man who made his reputation as a pickup artist. He slept with women in every country in the world. He's like Don Giovanni, Nella España, Mille e Tre, okay? And now he has realized that that's pointless, and he's coming back to traditional sexual morality, largely because I helped him when he read my book, Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. So individually, yes, there is always the possibility of conversion. Whether the culture can turn around, that's another matter. I tend to be pessimistic in this regard. One of the chapters I just did in my book on Logos is the chapter on Vico. And Vico, the Italian philosopher, felt that cultures were like organisms. They grow up, they grow old, and they die. And we may be watching the death of the American, I think we are certainly watching the death of the American empire, and all we can hope for is a new, a renaissance to come out of it. It's not, it happened before. The Roman Empire died. It collapsed. It was the most powerful empire on earth. It collapsed, and it was replaced by something better, although at the beginning it didn't seem that way. There was lots of chaos after the fall of the Roman Empire, but eventually what emerged out of it was the Holy Roman Empire, which was basically the Catholic kingdom of Middle Europe, the Germany, the German principalities, which gave birth to the notion of labor as the source of all value. So in any way, what I'm trying to say here is just because the empire dies doesn't mean it's the end of the world. It could be the birth of something better and something new here, as it was with the death of the Roman Empire.
Well, let's hope there is something new coming, because in the 1960s, when birth control pills started becoming popular, that's when there was an effort to teach sex ed in the public schools. And the innocent parents, I'll call them the naive parents, thought that the public schools were just teaching biological facts, not realizing they were teaching a philosophy. And so now what they did is they sexualized all the school children and kept pushing it to younger and younger ages. And I don't know if it can be reversed. What it would take, I would think, is a whole new generation that rejects this. But even when I was in the Missouri State Legislature, I tried to propose a law that removed a mandate from the sex ed curriculum, and oh, did I get an avalanche of opposition, from my fellow Republicans. They're like, you can't do that. People, right. Well, then you'll have all these illegitimate babies if you do that, and who's going to pay for them?
That was the Republican Party's agenda. It was clearly eugenic, and it was basically an updated, the 60s in places like Pennsylvania was the attempt on the WASP, by the WASP elite or the Republican Party, however you want to define it, to basically see birth control as the solution to the Negro problem. That's how it got institutionalized. That's how it was pushed in places like Philadelphia. And the result was what you could expect if you poured gasoline on a fire. The illegitimacy rate at that time in 1963 was 21% among blacks. It's now up to 80%, largely because the government interfered in family through the welfare establishment and promoted irresponsible sexual activity, which is what you get when you use birth control. Birth control is bad. It's intrinsically evil. It should not be tolerated at all, but certainly the government should not be involved in it at all. The government should not fund this. Those battles were lost in 1965. And I have to say, once again, it was largely through the influence of people like Father Hesburgh at Notre Dame, who was working clandestinely for the Rockefellers, who lost that battle by betraying the interest of the Catholic Church. And we have been suffering the consequences ever since.
Yeah, we have. Well, thank you for your insights. And I want you to leave us with one gem. Just give us a nugget to think about. What is the most important thing we can do if we want to engage in the culture wars and if we want to start winning?
Start a family. Raise children. Take control of your own household, and eventually we will win out. Because the other side, do not become involved in sterile, transient relationships, sexual relationships. Do not act like a homosexual. Even if you're a heterosexual, do not act like a homosexual by engaging in these transient, sterile relationships. Use that gift to create new life, a new cell in the society, and that will be the hope of the future.
Well, thank you. We need some hope for the future. So I appreciate you being with us today. Thank you for giving us some time out of your very busy day. I know you're writing articles and books and doing your part to change the world. I hope we get to interview you again when your next book comes out. Do you have another book coming out?
Yeah, the History of Logos and the Logos of History. I'm hoping it'll be out by the end of the year.
It sounds like a great plan. And if people want to sign up for Culture Wars magazine or contact you, how do they do that?
Go to culturewars.com.
There we go, culturewars.com. Thank you so much, E. Michael Jones. You have a great afternoon.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This has been another edition of Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, and I thank you for joining us. We're taking America back one family at a time. I sincerely hope you heard something that left you feeling inspired, motivated, and ready to engage our culture. If you enjoyed our show, you can find more at cynthiadavis.net. You can also find me on Facebook at Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Have a great week, and make sure you come back next time for another edition of Homefront.